I always assume people understand the basics. And I really don't think the majority of people do. So the whole idea of we're publicly traded, what does that mean? We have equity that's traded in the public markets. Most people still don't get that we're trading all day, every day. That means nothing to us other than if we're trading down, it can put a whole lot of pressure on us and cause pain and suffering and difficulty getting to the capital markets. But people actually think because we're publicly trading our equity, that's coming our way, which it's not. And this is something I take for granted that people understand. I don't think they do.
Hello, listeners. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Chats That Matter podcast, the only podcast exclusively for employees of Cincinnati Bell, Inc. That's CBTS, Onyx Hawaiian Telecom, and of course, Cincinnati Bell. Today, we're going to pop in on Josh Pickler interviewing CBI Chief Financial Officer Andy Kaiser. The following interview hits really salient points about finance, Wall Street, and other valuations. This is a longer episode than normal, but it's really important. So let's settle in and take a listen.
At a basic level, Andy, we have to publicly report our earnings every 3 months. Can you just, at a high level, go through why we have to do that, you know, what it means that we're a public company, what our responsibilities are in terms of sharing that information as a starting point?
Sure. So to your point, we are publicly traded, and I'm not certain that everyone has a complete understanding of what that means to be publicly traded. What that requires us to do is every quarter, to the comment that you made, we have to produce a set of publicly available financials. And we have to do that at a time that the entire market can see that information and digest that information and decide what they want to do, whether come in and buy our stock, continue to hold it, or sell it. That's why we release our information before the opening of the stock market. The market opens at 9:30. We tend to drop our quarterly financials around 7:30, 8 a.m. That gives analysts and others opportunity to review the material, digest it, and then call in and ask us questions. What it means to be publicly traded, we have common stock that we issued many, many years ago, that when we issued it, we were given the proceeds from the sale of that initial offering. Once we do that, we then have a base of shareholders that each have, with one share, they have a vote. And with that vote, they can vote on critical matters that are important to this organization and the management of this organization. So with common stock, they don't get any dividend. We are not a dividend paying company, and they're not entitled to any form of dividend. But what they are entitled to is a voice. And that voice can be very powerful. So there are folks out there that hold our stock on an individual basis, and they might have a handful of shares. And there are institutions that hold millions of dollars worth of our stock. And so when we report our earnings to the public, both individuals as well as institutional investors are interested to hear how we've done in the prior quarter, what that looks like relative to previous quarters, and then ultimately, and probably most importantly, they want to know what we think future quarters look like. We won't give specific guidance around what the next quarter or the quarter after that looks like, but we have at that point already given specific guidance as to what we think the year looks like from an EBITDA perspective, from a revenue perspective, and an earnings per share perspective. We also will provide capital guidance when we give those numbers to the street.
So for employees, what are the important numbers in these earnings? Because obviously they come out, there's a slew of numbers. And you just mentioned, I think, three: revenue, EBITDA, and EPS, and all those are different. So for the average employee, what numbers or numbers are the important ones to pay attention to?
Sure. And I get that question a lot, and I've actually asked bankers that question a lot because they all matter. At times, they can work against one another, which we can get into in a moment if you want. So we're publicly traded. We have four analysts that cover us, and they give consensus, meaning they put out their estimates for what they think we will do in the coming year for revenue, EBITDA, and earnings per share. And, you know, I would say if I were asked what is the single most important, it's EBITDA, right? EBITDA is ultimately a decent proxy for cash. Now, outside of EBITDA, we spend a lot of capital. We will give guidance around capital. Now, the analysts won't put out there a consensus around our capital spend, but they talk about it in their reports because we talk about it. And it's incredibly important because when you think of what is EBITDA, EBITDA is essentially the cash that we generate as an organization from ongoing operations. With that cash, we have to do a handful of things. We have to reinvest in the company. So when you hear CapEx or capital expenditures, for the most part, unless we borrow in order to invest, the majority of our CapEx comes from the EBITDA that we produce. But we also have to pay interest on the debt that we have, that we have in place, that's been in place for many, many years, and also debt that we have in place for the acquisition of Onyx and the merger with Hawaiian Telcom. So our analysts look very closely at those two measures, EBITDA and capital expenditures, because one impacts the other, which then in turn impacts the other. It is a bit of a cycle. So as we invest and spend CapEx, that drives revenue, which drives EBITDA, which allows us to invest further. So the investing community is acutely aware of what our EBITDA looks like by quarter, what that growth trajectory looks like, and then ultimately the capital that we are going to spend. That means either at the end of the day, we have free cash flow available to do different things. We could do share repurchases. Theoretically, we could put in place a dividend, which we're not going to do. We could pay down debt, which we've done historically. There's a lot of uses of that cash if we don't use it to reinvest in the company. Right now, we are absolutely in an investment cycle. It's very important that we continue to invest the cash that we generate, which is what we've been doing. So when we talk about Phioptics on the calls, when we talk about Phioptics in leadership meetings, that is where a large percentage of our capital is going, which ultimately is the EBITDA that we are generating is then being deployed as capital in order for us to build out our fiber network.
So I've noticed a lot of times when we release earnings, you'll see headlines, and the headlines almost always refer to EPS, earnings per share, and not EBITDA. And it's come up a couple times in meetings with Lee or you as well. Employee will mention, well, we missed EPS. And it seems like for our company, the earnings per share is not as important of a metric as EBITDA, like you were just saying. But to the outside, it seems like they're very interested in it. So can you talk about that? What is earnings per share, and when is it relevant, and when is it maybe misleading?
Sure. So it's funny, the news outlets that pick up EPS, I'm not sure why they pick up EPS, because of the sector that we're in. We are in an investment cycle, and I'll get into a second what EPS. So EPS is earnings per share, which is literally the bottom line of the income statement, net income, which net income is a whole lot of non-cash stuff that gets to net income. So when I talk about EBITDA, which is earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization, that largely reflects all of the cash operations. For the most part, EBITDA is cash. When you get all the way down to net income, there's a whole lot of non-cash stuff in that number, including depreciation and amortization, which are very big numbers. Because of all of the investing that we've been doing year over year over year, we depreciate those assets on a steady clip. That depreciation, which is non-cash. So I don't mean to over-explain, but I think this is important for people to understand. So we make investments in long-lived assets like fiber that could be in place 30, 40, 50 years. we depreciate at a different pace in accordance with GAAP and a whole lot of other stuff that nobody on this call is going to care about. But know that we depreciate at a clip that is clearly not necessarily reflective of how long those assets are going to be in place and will generate cash flow for this company. So the reason EPS can be a confusing number in this sector and specific to Cincinnati Bell is we are in an investment cycle. We are spending lots of capital. With that, we then have a really big depreciation number that sits below EBITDA that brings our net income down significantly. So then that number is measured against the number of shares of stock that we have outstanding, which is how you get earnings per share. It's on a per share basis. So most, if not all, of the folks that really follow us, the analysts that are out there, the sell side analysts that are talking about us, that have anywhere from a buy to a hold to a sell recommendation on our stock, to the big institutional investors, and even, I would say, the well-informed individual investors, EPS is just not a meaningful number. When we provide guidance, we will put out and talk with analysts around what we think EPS is going to look like, but there's just a lot of variables and moving parts that make it, A, difficult to predict, and B, it's just not very reflective of what we are doing as an organization. So most organizations ignore it, but to your point, Josh, the problem is when that's a headline by a news outlet and they'll say, Cincinnati Bell missed EPS, it seems like a big story.
You've mentioned the analysts a couple times. Who are the analysts? Who do they work for? Who reads their reports?
Sure.
Who are these?
So we currently have four sell-side analysts that follow us, and I'll get into sort of what they do, what their role is, and ultimately what they're trying to achieve. So we have Jennifer Fritchie with Wells Fargo that currently has a buy on our stock. We have Batya Levy, who's with UBS. She has a hold on our stock. We have Simon Flannery from Morgan Stanley, who's been following us for a very long time. Simon's been following us going back during the Broadwing days. And finally, we have David Barden with BAML, which is Bank of America Merrill Lynch. And again, all four have been following us for quite a while. They're sell-side analysts. What that means is they make recommendations on stocks all over the place. In this case, they happen to make recommendations on Cincinnati Bell. We are traded on the New York Stock Exchange under the symbol CBB. And their recommendations are followed by folks, individuals as well as institutions, that want to have an understanding of a company that maybe they're considering moving into, maybe they're considering getting out of. So they are followed by folks that have an interest in particular stocks that those analysts follow or cover. You'll hear it both ways. Really what they're trying to do is if they've got a buy on us, they're trying to convince people to buy. And when they do, they're hopeful that people will buy through their organization. So, you know, as an example, Jennifer Fritchie with Wells Fargo would love for people to buy Cincinnati Bell on her recommendation and to buy through Wells Fargo. Similarly, Batya Levy would hope that folks would buy through her organization, which is UBS. And conversely, when sell-side analysts have a sell on your stock, they actually hope that people sell through their organization. So sell-side analysts are out there following closely companies. They talk to management regularly, and we'll probably get into that momentarily. The call that we host is actually a sell-side analyst call, and I don't know that a lot of folks know that. They think it's our earnings call, but those earnings calls are really exclusively for the sell-side analysts that follow the company.
Can you talk about the difference between a sell-side analyst and a buy-side analyst?
Sure. So sell-side, which it's kind of a strange name, I think, because you hear sell-side, yet they're out there promoting a stock for people to buy or hold or sell. But sell-side are independent And the idea is I'm just giving you my research, and you, the individual, or you, the big institutional investor, can read my report and make decisions on whether you should buy or sell or hold this particular instrument. And they're constantly putting out reports. Every time we talk to them, almost moments after I have conversations with these analysts, you'll see their reports dropping based on the things that I told them and the numbers that we released for that quarter. And again, what they hope is folks follow their advice and will either buy, hold, or sell. So that's sell side. Buy side are, so think of big institutional funds, the folks that are internal actually making purchases for those funds. So the buy side are the folks that are deciding what to put into a big pension or put into a big mutual fund. They are managing and making recommendations to buy or sell within their portfolios versus providing independent assessments of companies that are out there publicly traded, allowing folks to make that decision. They are actually actively buying and selling shares, where the sell side are just making recommendations to do so.
But do all of them put out their own reports and analysis on how we're doing as a company, or are there just certain analysts who?
So the sell side analysts put out the reports.
Okay.
The sell side analysts are, whenever you hear about, hey, a new report dropped on Cincinnati Bell or any other company. So Frontier is a good example, since there's been so much talk about Frontier and kind of the issues they've been going through over the past several years. There's constantly reports being dropped on Frontier regarding what folks think they need to do, are currently doing, are doing poorly, are doing well, whatever the case may be. And so all of those reports that you see come from sell-side analysts that cover Frontier, or they could cover us, and they may mention, that happens all the time, we are in a sector, so we are often compared against what a particular sell-side analyst deems our closest peers or competitors. So often we'll be included. It could be a report on Frontier, but they talk about Cincinnati Bell. They talk about Windstream. They might talk about Century or Consolidated, and vice versa.
Why would an investor – so I was struck, too, you were talking about these analysts will put out their own kind of predictions for how we're going to do. And we're also giving our own guidance for the year. So why, I guess, would an investor depend on an analyst for that when the company's giving them, here's our guidance?
So I think it's important. And, in fact, I'm going on a non-deal roadshow. I leave today. And what I do on these really investor tours is I meet with a whole host of existing investors, potential investors, and they want to hear from me what I think about the company and the numbers. Now, I can't disclose anything non-public, so I could talk about our Q2 numbers. I could talk about things that we've publicly talked about. And that's an important source of information. But another important source is an independent analyst that's saying, okay, management may be a little rosier than we are. And that happens regularly. And there are times that it goes the other way, where the analyst is a bit rosier than management. So it's really just another opportunity for investors to talk with individuals that closely follow the operations of Cincinnati Bell and our peers. You know, I'll use, you know, as an example, many of these analysts have been in this space for 20, 30 years. So there's a certain level of credibility when they put out a report and say, well, here's what I think about this particular company, what I think about their projections. And it's just for whether an individual or an institution, another data point to help them decide, do I invest? Do I hold, or do I sell? Because realistically, those are the three options. I either get in, hold, or get out.
Can these analysts put out a report anytime they want about us? Because I, you know, so it seems there have been times when an analyst will drop a report that's not related to our earnings announcement. So it might be a month after, 2 months after. It's in between the earnings announcement cycle. But that report can have a big impact on the stock price. So can they basically put out a report on us at any time they like? And then what would drive them to do that?
Yeah, actually, they have the opportunity, the right to put out a report anytime that they feel there's information that is important for the investing public to be aware of. And sometimes, unfortunately, the timing is not great. And so I'll use a specific example that I think everybody is familiar with. So Simon Flannery from Morgan Stanley put out a report, and it was in late May. So we hadn't yet closed the Hawaiian Telcom transaction. We couldn't speak publicly about it because we hadn't closed. So we didn't own Hawaiian Telcom. We couldn't influence that organization, and we couldn't go out and publicly speak about their numbers because it was still under the control of Hawaiian Telcom shareholders. And so if anybody was going to speak publicly about that organization, it would have to be their management team, not ours. So it was unfortunate when Simon dropped that report because he had some estimates that were off the mark, but he felt that given what he had seen with Hawaiian Telcom's performance up to that point, that that was the new trajectory. So he dropped a report that we are unable to address for all the aforementioned reasons. And as a result, our stock responded pretty swiftly. So we talked, as you might imagine, I talked to a whole host of investors throughout that week. I interacted with our board so that they were familiar with what had happened, what, you know, kind of my interpretation of the situation was, and then ultimately what we needed to do on a go-forward basis. The most difficult thing was we couldn't come out with a press release. We couldn't go out and say, let's just have an earnings call and address this, that our hands were tied. And I had that conversation with Simon, and it was a good conversation where I said, your timing was horrible. Sure would have been nice if you had talked with us. And if you felt this way, that's absolutely your right. But could you have dropped this at a point in time that we could have responded? So what I didn't understand was his sense of urgency, why it needed to drop when we were getting close. And we had maintained that we thought we would close around the first part of the second half of the year, which is exactly when we closed. So the stock was affected. It dropped about 21% on the day. Within 3 to 4 weeks, we were back up trading in the same range where we had been. And that's where the multiple points of communication are important. We talked to many investors and said, look, we can't address this right now, but his view and our view are different. We can't give you, you know, any specific guidance outside of that. We don't think that his trajectory is the trajectory that we're going to see. And many people came back and said, actually, we think that his view is fairly negative, and we actually believe it's better than that. So what happens is a stock responds quickly. The stock market is referred to as, and this is really going to bore people, semi-strong form efficient. What that means is everybody thinks, well, it's immediate. Information is disseminated globally immediately, so it should be perfectly efficient, right? But it's not. There's always a lag. And that lag is tightened with now the lightning pace with which we can share information globally, but there's still a lag. And so what you'll see is a reaction, and our stock will drop substantially. And then a day later or a week later, without any further public information being released, we get back to where we were trading roughly. So long way of answering your question. Yes, they have the right anytime to drop a report on us. Often we will talk with them before they do that. Sometimes that precipitates it. If we say, hey, earnings we think are going to be up a bit or down a bit, and we kind of help them with guidance, they then will give revised guidance. And so that's often when you see reports drop, is through conversation with us around what we think revenue EBITDA is going to likely trend toward over the coming quarters.
So there was sort of the opposite example of that a couple of years ago. Where I think it was somebody who worked for one of our big investors put out a report that said, Cincinnati Bell would be a great acquisition target, which was not the first time. I don't think that's been said. And really, any company could be an acquisition target. But the stock went up like 20% right away. So in that scenario, what's going on there? What drives him to put that out? And I guess, how is he able to do that when he works for a firm that has a huge stake in our company and would, in theory, benefit from a really positive sort of, you know, report like that?
Yeah, that's actually a great question. And, you know, if you talk to folks in the banking industry, they will tell you there's a Chinese wall between the analysts and everybody else, all the other investment banking, which, you know, as you might imagine, you know, Simon Flannery covered us. Now, he did have to stop putting out reports for a period of time when we were doing the Onyx transaction and the HCOM transaction. Because despite that wall, they want to make certain there's no way that one can influence the other. So to your point, that was Gabelli. Now, Gabelli no longer covers us, really because their analysts shifted from the sell side to the buy side. How can they do that? Well, that's a good question. His view was, when you look at everything we had done up to that point, we had really cleaned up our balance sheet. We had deleveraged significantly. We invested heavily in fiber. We had really differentiated ourselves. So his view as a sell-side analyst was, hey, we think that this organization would be a prime candidate for a larger organization that wants a big fiber footprint in Cincinnati and wants the IT services assets that come with that. As a result, people see that. And then here's where it can get a bit clouded, I think. Folks understand that there's this wall between the two sides. But just like your question, folks are going to say, yeah, but given that on the other side, they own 10% of the company, seems like maybe they might know something more than others. You know, that this was a bit... And I want to go back to the Simon report, because this was a bit of, I think, what happened with Simon and why the reaction was so dramatic, just like the example on the other side that you're describing from a couple of years ago. Morgan was our lead bank on the two transactions. And so when Morgan's sell side analyst comes out and says something, despite the wall, folks immediately assume, sheesh, I bet he knows more than the average Joe. And so there's a quick, somewhat visceral reaction. So the same thing happened with Gabelli. I think a lot of folks say, yeah, I get that there's a wall. But Mario Gabelli owns 10% of this company. At the time, it was beyond 10%. And so there's a quick reaction. This gets back to the whole semi-strong form efficient. People react, and then eventually people say, well, that was just an analyst saying that this could happen, which, by the way, they've been saying forever. You know, when I came into this company in 2000, the then CFO, Brian Ross, talked to me about we likely were a candidate for acquisition in 2000. I still have analyst reports from 2000 from Simon Flannery that said they likely are going to get acquired. So... You just never, though, can predict which of those can cause a stock to move by 20%. Anytime a stock moves up or down 20%+, that is fairly uncommon. Stocks move all over the place, but to move 20%+ up or down is not that common, and it tends to be noteworthy.
So that kind of brings us to a couple of weeks ago where we issued our last earnings release, and I think the day we issued the earnings, the stock went down 20%. Or maybe living a little more, and the next day it was back up to where it had been. What happened there?
You know, that's one of those moments that there really is no logical explanation. I was a stockbroker many, many years ago, and I used to tell my clients, if you're going to watch the market every day, every week, and that's going to concern you for your future. Now, you just mapped out for me that you want to retire in 30 years. I've set forth a strategy that will absolutely put you in exceptional in an exceptional place to be able to do that, right? However, if you're going to watch the stock every week, every month, and you're going to call me daily wondering what's going on with the stock, you probably shouldn't be in the market. So this again goes back to the occasional volatility that just doesn't have a real rational explanation. When we released the numbers, we were up about 6%. When the market opened, we were up. Now, it was on light volume, but we were up 6%. Now, if you look back historically, when we release numbers, if we're up out of the gate, we tend to stay up. If we're down out of the gate, we tend to stay down. And again, it just sort of is what it is. On that particular day, it was on light volume, but out of the gate, we were up a little over 6%. And then it just started to slide. So if you look at our numbers, we released numbers that were in line with, so all the discussion that we've had around analysts that cover us, what people want to know is, are you in line with analyst guidance? And we absolutely were. In fact, we had slightly outperformed EBITDA. We were in line with revenue. EPS was a miss, but again, EPS folks tend to completely discard as a meaningful metric. Capital was in line. The metrics look strong. So we thought that we were going to see a pretty solid day. You never know. I hate to predict because you can get it wrong. And we were down 22% at the end of the day. Every analyst that I spoke with, every investor, so these are folks that are plugged into Wall Street every day, all day, and follow stocks. The first question that they asked me was, what the heck is going on with your stock? Well, you know, do you have an explanation? And we clarified the Hawaiian Telcom numbers that Simon had put out there. And it was, you know, drastically improved from what Simon had put out. And you saw the reaction from Simon's report. So then the next day, so we're looking at all the potential causes, and there was really nothing to point to. The next day, we rebound and we're up 20%+. Now, one thing I want to clarify there, when you're down 20%+ and then you're up 20%+ the next day, that doesn't get you back to where you were. But it was a nice recovery. And all we could see was, so when we merged with Hawaiian Telcom, we acquired about 7.5 million shares and shareholders that came with the transaction. We don't know them well. We don't have long history with them. And it looks like one of those investors put in a big block sell. Well, when that happens, and you look at our average volume, so we trade around generally around 400 to 500,000 shares on any given day. If somebody pushes through a large block sell, it can create a bit of an avalanche where everybody says, well, if that block trade is coming, I want to get out before the stock starts to slide. That's the only thing we can really point to, because nothing else is obvious or apparent as to what would cause that slide. And then the ultimate rebound the next day, other than a bit of an irrational reaction to a big block sale that went through.
Why, at a high level, is a company stock price important? Beyond, you know, obviously if you're an owner of the stock, you want it to go up. But just in your role, you know, the price of the stock, why is that important, what the stock is doing over, you know, a long period of time?
Sure.
Or is it?
No, absolutely. It's critically important. And this is probably an opportunity for me to explain, you know, there's the initial process of us raising capital, and we are paid the net proceeds of issuing common stock. Then after that moment, so I'll just use an example. If we raised $1 billion in capital through stock, we do that one time, it's issued to the market, we get the $1 billion net of fees, and now that stock trades freely all day, every day. So a lot of people say, well, once you've raised, you know, the money, who cares? It's trading, it could trade up or down. How does that affect you? Why do you care? Well, it's critically important on an absolute basis and on a relative basis, because we need to operate every day, every week, every month, every quarter in the capital markets. When we go, if we say, hey, we need to go raise debt, for an acquisition, or we have debt that is reaching a maturity. So I guess I'll start there because this is an important example. Imagine we had notes, bonds that were mature in a year, and they were $500 million worth of notes coming due. Well, obviously, years ago, when we first issued those notes, what we said was it's a promise. And bondholders, unlike common shareholders, bondholders actually have rights, which are driven by an indenture, legal rights that say you're going to pay me interest on a semi-annual basis, and it's going to be at this coupon. And at the end of all of this, when these bonds come mature, you're going to pay me the principal value back. I'm just lending you the money. I'm not a shareholder. I have no rights other than I've let you borrow money subject to an indenture that drives what I can and can't do. So if we had a bond deal that was maturing in a year, we don't have $500 million laying around, right? So what we have to do is refinance that debt. If your stock is not performing well, and if folks at that point in time aren't feeling real good about the trajectory of your stock and the opportunities that you have in the market that you play, your access to capital markets is very limited. And what can happen is really one of, and we're seeing this with folks that aren't where we are by way of the balance sheet that we have in place, the runway that we've got, the potential that we have with the fiber that we've invested in over the past several years. You either can't refinance, and if that happens, that's very bad. And so there are some out there that you'll hear bankers say, I don't know if they're going to be able to refinance. Well, if you can't refinance, you've got significant problems. Or you can refinance, but it's extremely expensive. So if the rest of the market is out there floating unsecured notes, and all that means is there's no real assets that sit behind them other than your ability to generate cash as an organization, while some, and this is a real example, while some people are out there raising unsecured debt at 6%, so their cost to borrow is 6%, there are others issuing debt at 19%. Well, you can imagine if this is a big note or bond offering that you're taking out and refinancing, paying 19% on that debt is crushing. And then it affects your ability to do all the other things that you need to do to continue to grow as an organization. So where we trade is followed closely by not only the equity investors, but also credit investors. And, you know, in fact, when I go on these roadshows, often I'm talking with our creditors, people that hold hundreds of millions of dollars in our debt, because it's all one big ecosystem, and the performance of one affects the performance of the other. So often if our equity isn't performing real well, our debt will be trading off. Not always. Sometimes if our debt's trading off, it causes our equity to trade off. So it is critically important that we continue to execute, continue to hit our numbers, so that the shareholders of our stock say, I like what you guys are up to, and you continue to see upward momentum with our stock. It then tends to mean good things with our debt holders, which again, without that, can cause issues in accessing the capital markets.
Well, Andy, thanks for your time today. We appreciate it.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it as well.
As always, thanks for listening to the Chats That Matter podcast. This episode was recorded and narrated by Annette DiTommaso. That's me. With editing and producing by Jonah Wilson. Special thanks to our special guests, Andy Kaiser and Josh Pickler. Our quality assurance guest was Jane Weiler. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts, please send us an email at ctmpodcast@sinbell.com. Again, that's CTM Charlie Tango Mike podcast@sinbell.com.